print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Smithsonian. Smithsonian is generously supported by the Kepin family. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled, How to Save an Orangutan, text by Helen Sullivan. A sanctuary in Borneo is giving the endangered primates a second chance. The baby orangutans were trying to stall before bedtime. One reached out to grab a particularly long leaf through the bars of its cage, encouraging a human to play, then employed a classic toddler sabotage technique, needing to pee. Eventually, the orangutan relented, climbing up a jungle gym-like structure in an otherwise empty, if messy, room. The floor was littered with sticks and pieces of wood. The baby orangutan settled into a small hammock and pulled a large leaf over its body as a blanket. In the wild, orangutans build new nests every night, weaving leaves and branches together and curling up in the tree canopy. But this was not the wild, not quite. This was the site of the world's largest orangutan conservation organization, the Borneo Orangutan Survival Foundation, or BOSF, based in the Indonesian part of the island, also known as Kalimantan. The day before, I had watched an adult female standing on a concrete platform on a lush, artificial island surrounded by water, hold a large palm frond over her body to shield herself from the rain. A permanent resident, she was too tame to be released back into the wild, and independent enough not to have to live in a cage. Nearby, a large male conducted high-level negotiations with his keeper, who was trying to get him to eat his carrots before a dessert of dragon fruit. Resplendent in impossibly sleek, long, and unmatted orange fur, he poked a stick into the deep water between himself and the keeper. "If you don't give me the dragon fruit now," he seemed to be saying, "I'll just have to come over there and get it myself." Orangutans share 97% of their DNA with humans. Somewhere in that missing 3% was the transparency of the orangutan's bluff. The keeper knew that the orangutan couldn't swim. If you haven't been to Borneo, you may imagine it as a land of dense tropical jungle and strange living things. Giant flowers, abundant leeches, venomous snakes dangling from vines. In his 1984 memoir, Into the Heart of Borneo, the English writer Redmond O'Hanlon described it like this, quote, 200-foot-high trees crowded down the slopes of the hills, almost to the water's edge, an apparently endless chaos of different species of tree, every kind of green, even under the uniform glare of a tropical sun, end quote. At the time, 3/4 of Borneo was covered in rainforest. Now almost half of that land has been cleared. The view from my plane as I descended was of coal barges fanning out from the coast. The airport is a large, gleaming white and silver building with a Dunkin' Donuts inside the arrivals lounge. But Borneo's remaining forest has some of the highest species diversity on Earth. According to the World Wildlife Fund for Nature, with one area of Lambeer Hills National Park in Sarawak, Malaysia, holding the world record for tree diversity, more than 1,000 species in 125 acres. And each of these holds its own great diversity, too. Scientists have found 1,000 species of insect in a single tree. Overall, Borneo is home to 6% of the world's biodiversity. Nearly 90% of all orangutans in the world can be found there. The rest are on the Indonesian island of Sumatra. Because orangutans spend almost all their time up in the trees, the island's deforestation, mainly from palm oil farming and mining, is the biggest threat they face. Borneo's orangutan population halved between 1999 and 2015, from 300,000 to 150,000. In the decade since then, the population has declined by another third to 100,000 today. A 2022 study predicted that more than a quarter of today's population could be lost to deforestation by 2032. All of this makes BOSF's work more crucial than ever. Since the foundation was established in 1991, it has released 533 orangutans, and it maintains 359 permanent residents that are too tame, diseased, or disabled to live in the world, in the wild. Depending on their circumstances, these residents live in cages or on artificial islands in the foundation's two centers in East and Central Kalimantan. There are 20 orangutans with diseases living in one set of tall cages, raised off the ground and set apart from one another. As we approached these cages one morning, a female wanting to get a closer look at us moved down a rope with the agility of a pole dancer. Farther up a sloped parkway was a network of 10 silver cages on stilts high above the ground. There, one of the longtime residents, an orangutan named Copral, who lost both of his arms after being electrocuted and could not survive in the wild, did a forward flip from one end of his cage to the other. The animals face a formidable new test. Indonesia, the world's fourth most populous country after India, China, and the United States, is moving its capital from the sinking island of Java to a planned city called Nusantara on Borneo, 40 miles from BOSF's East Kalimantan Center. Construction began in 2022 and is scheduled to finish in 2045. The government hopes 1.9 million people will live in Nusantara. By 2035, Indonesian Borneo's population will grow from 17 million to 20 million. Indonesia's government says Nusantara will be a quote-unquote green forest city, with all its energy drawn from renewable sources and residents mostly traveling by foot, bicycle, or public transportation. The government says the city will be carbon neutral by 2045. Still, it is hard to counteract the environmental impacts of the construction of an entire city in a place where there had only been trees. Last year, workers took a video of an orangutan crossing a construction site for a road leading to the new city. It would be truly remarkable if such large-scale infrastructure development did not negatively affect threatened species. Andrew Marshall, a tropical ecologist at the University of Michigan, who has studied orangutans in Borneo, told me in an email, quote, "Such projects always do," he added. "There are good reasons related to human welfare for moving the capital to Kalimantan. It is an understandable move, but it is likely to have considerable downsides. There are always trade-offs," end quote. It takes diplomacy to keep the foundation's sanctuary going in a place where so many people are struggling. Across Kalimantan's five provinces, almost two-thirds of the population live below the poverty line. Caring for a single orangutan costs $500 a month, according to Jamartin Sihit, a conservationist and one of BOSF's trustees. But BOSF's website invites overseas donors to symbolically adopt an orangutan for as little as $10 a month. That's because local Indonesians, who earn an average of $350 a month, might turn against conservation efforts if they felt that orangutans were earning higher salaries than they were. Quote, they will say, "How could you put money to an orangutan, not to us?" Sihate said. "To make people not look at orangutan as their competitors, this is part of the strategy," end quote. What are the traits we share with our large orange relatives? Orangutans treat their wounds with medicinal plants. They make tools and keep their favorites for future use. But there are many traits we don't share. Their arms are 1.5 times as long as their legs, which helps them climb from branch to branch in what's known as, quote, quadrumanus scrambling, end quote. They are the most solitary of great apes, a group that includes gorillas, bonobos, chimpanzees, and us. When their genome was sequenced in 2011, scientists discovered orangutans have changed very little in the past 15 million years compared with people and chimpanzees. Orangutans have the longest birth interval of any land mammal. They have a second child only once the first is independent. which takes about 7 years. Producing so few young is one reason they struggled to rebound their populations. Like humans, female orangutans can get postpartum depression, particularly those who lost their own mothers in traumatic incidents. Quote, when the baby is crying just because it's a newborn baby, the mother doesn't want to hug it, doesn't want to breastfeed. Quote, Agus Erwanto, one of the foundation's veterinarians, said, if a mother doesn't show interest within 3 days, the baby is taken from her. Depressed mothers don't seem to notice a baby's absence. Teaching a baby orangutan to survive requires years of close attention. Irwanto laughs when he talks about quote-unquote jungle school. The school's technicians teach the orangutans how to climb, what to eat, and how to find it, and how to make a nest. Because orangutans learn by imitation, the technicians act out these activities. The animals tend to bond more with some technicians than others. They're picky, Irwanto said. Trial and error has shown that women are much better at the job. The foundation suspects that is because, in many cases, the orangutan's mothers have been killed by men, whose deep voices then scare them. Once the orangutans graduate, they're placed on a small, semi-wild island, several acres of land hemmed in by constructed canals. The orangutans must prove that they can be independent. It's time for tough love. But Irwanto sums up in two heartbreaking sentences, quote, we don't hug them, we don't say their name, end quote. If the orangutans are able to climb, build nests, find food, and interact with the other orangutans, they are fitted with telemetric chips and placed in cages for their release. The three release sites managed by BOSF are 12 hours from the sanctuary by car. BOSF researchers spent the next year monitoring the newly wild orangutans. As the animals enjoy their freedom, some of them roam out of the range of radio signals, which means the monitoring team has to search the jungle on foot to find them. The hardest thing about this, one young researcher told me, is how sore your neck gets from staring up at the canopy. The building that houses BOSF's visitors resembles an orangutan, though I was told that this was not by design. 3 stories tall, it has large arm and leg-like orange wooden pillars, and it is thatched with a material that has the texture of long, dark hair. That's the thing about orangutans. Once you've seen one, it's hard not to recognize them in all sorts of things. During my visit, Aldrinato Priajati, the habitat's deputy director, gave a presentation in the open-air dining room. As he began, heavy drops of rain landed loudly on the large, bright leaves behind us. Priajati changed slides and gestured at the surroundings, tall, thin trees covered in long, tangled vines. On the screen was a photograph of how the land had looked 20 years ago, all grassland with no trees. In the early 2000s, BOSF began restoring about almost 5,000 acres. First, it planted 740 native tree species. Local residents were offered a deal. As long as they helped to protect the trees, they could use the land to grow fruit. Fruit trees attracted bats, birds, and other animals that spread seeds without the need for more digging. Since then, the foundation has been purchasing fruit from the farmers to feed its animals, which eat more than 2 tons of it daily. The land also houses one of the world's largest sun bear sanctuaries, also run by BOSF. The reforested area was too large to fence. For now, there is something of what Priajati calls a quote-unquote natural-unnatural fence made up of coal mines. Borneo provides 60% of Indonesia's coal exports. Illegal mining is also rife. Recent estimates of the scale of illegal mining are difficult to find, but in 2014, Indonesia's government estimated that at least 55 million tons of coal were mined and exported illegally from the country. For now, most of the land owned or managed by BOSF has been designated a conservation area. Because of BOSF's success in regenerating forest, the Indonesian government is consulting with the sanctuary on how to redevelop lands around the new capital, which is built largely on rainforest that was cleared for plantations, Sihit said. BOSF is advising the government on which tree species to plant and lobbying for more rainforested land to be legally protected. Still, Marshall of the University of Michigan is concerned, quote, secondary negative effects of infrastructure development will likely be considerable and spread far from the site itself, he told me. Massive projects such as this nearly always have unanticipated consequences, end quote. After sunset one evening, I drove to Nusantara with an orangutan researcher named Amanda Rama. The journey, which should have taken an hour and a half, took almost 4 hours, as we spent much of it behind slow trucks carrying cement mixers, industrial pipes, and water tanks. Forests gave way to low buildings, then suddenly there were tall apartment blocks and a half-finished hospital. Forklifts and bulldozers roamed like dinosaurs after dark. The dust reminded Rama of her visits to landscapes destroyed by mines and palm oil plantations, she said. But even she was not immune to the splendor of a city built from scratch. The Garuda, she yelled as we drove farther into what had first looked like a construction site. Ahead of us was a giant building shaped like Garuda, a divine eagle from Hindu mythology. It wasn't finished yet. Sparks flew as construction continued late into the night. The light appeared to drip off its outstretched wings like shining feathers. In April, the foundation released 6 orangutans into the wild. 3 of them had taken more than 15 years to rehabilitate. They arrived at the center as toddlers, before the city of Nusantara was a twinkle in the Indonesian government's eye. By then I was back home in Sydney, Australia, where my own toddler reminded me of an orangutan more often than I wanted to admit. I kept thinking about the fact that the enormous animals I had seen had changed so little in 15 million years, and yet a city had been conjured from scratch in just 3 years. In the time it would have taken an orangutan mother to raise 2 offspring, from 1999 to 2015, half of the island's orangutans had died. The species urgently needs saving, and yet none of the work can happen quickly, from shutting down an illegal coal mine that could raise hundreds of trees in a few hours, to teaching an orphan baby to dig for termites. Humans still have time to restore what our developments have destroyed, but it'll be so much easier to prevent the destruction that's yet to come. Now we'll move on to an article titled Good Havens by Brandon Tensley. Frank Kameny helped chart a path to liberation for millions of Americans. In 1957, Frank Kameny, a 32-year-old astronomer with the Army Map Service, was on a work trip to Hawaii and the West Coast when he was told to report back to Washington, D.C. for questioning. There, civil service investigators asked him to respond to reports that he was gay. I don't see how it's relevant to any rational concern or business of the government, Kameny, a World War II veteran, recalled answering. He was soon fired. The official cause cited was that he had falsified his job application, an official government document, by downplaying his arrest for quote-unquote lewd behavior with another man the previous year. Kameny told the government he'd been arrested for quote-unquote disorderly conduct, a less grave sin in those days. At the time, the government deemed gay Americans to be security risks and effectively banned them from federal service. These were the days of the Lavender Scare, which grew out of the anti-communist panic of the 1940s and 50s. Kameny appealed his dismissal in various courts and in 1961 petitioned the United States Supreme Court to take up his case. The court declined to review it. Furious, Kameny would devote his life to fighting homophobia. We are here to stay, we are part of American life and society, and you will be seeing a lot more of us, he declared in a 1969 letter. Born in New York City on May 21, 1925, to a Jewish family, Kameny became a trailblazing activist for gay civil rights. In 1961, after his fruitless petitions to the Supreme Court, Kameny co-founded the Washington, D.C. chapter of the Mattachine Society, a pioneering organization with what was then called the homophile movement, the pre-Stonewall campaign for gay equality. 4 years later, the group led the first recorded gay rights picket of the White House, protesting the government's banning of gay Americans from the federal service. Homosexual citizens want to serve their country, too. Sexual preference is irrelevant to federal employment. These were radical messages for the era. Kameny neatly captured his ethos in the slogan, Gay is Good, which he coined in 1968 inspired by the Black Power mantra, Black is beautiful. For those within the community, the phrase certainly instilled some pride to counterbalance the rhetoric of gays are going to hell, says Franklin A. Robinson, Jr., an archivist with the National Museum of American History. And Khamenei aptly linked the struggle for gay rights to other battles for equality. We are interested in obtaining rights for our respective minorities as Negroes, as Jews, and as homosexuals, he proclaimed at a 1964 public meeting at Freedom House, a Washington-based nonprofit. In 1971, Khamenei became the first openly gay person to run for U.S. Congress. As he vied to serve as Washington's delegate to the House of Representatives, he presented himself as a candidate who had something to offer everybody. I was very conscious of running a double-barreled, double-issue campaign, he recalled to Washingtonian Magazine in 2010. If you're going to run for public office, you have to become an expert on trash collection, road repair, and all the things that concerned people. But I was running a parallel campaign on gay issues. While Khamenei lost his bid, he played a big role in pressuring the American Psychiatric Association to remove homosexuality from its list of mental illnesses and disorders in 1973. And some two decades later, he lobbied President Bill Clinton to sign a 1995 executive order banning anti-gay discrimination and federal security clearances. In 2009, 2 years before he died, the U.S. government issued an apology to Khamenei for his 1957 termination. Khamenei's idealism is especially vivid in the pages of five notebooks he kept beginning in the 1950s. They held information about places across the U.S. that were gay-friendly, from bars to restaurants to hotels. Two of the notebooks are in the Archives Center of the National Museum of American History. Khamenei described the sports lounge in Springfield, Massachusetts as, quote-unquote, the best in town. Sam's Place in Chicago apparently drew a, quote, a younger crowd, end quote. And over in the resort town of Algonquin, Maine, while the owners of the Tides Hotel were non-members, they were sympathetic to gay travelers. It's a mystery what Khamenei intended to do with the notebooks, written in terse language and sometimes hard to decipher. Robinson speculates it's possible Khamenei wanted to publish them, in which case they would have been precursors to Bob Dameron's address book, popular guides published starting in the 1960s that allowed gays and lesbians to find sites of acceptance and community, essentially gay versions of the Green Book, which black motorists used to avoid discriminatory businesses and potential violence under Jim Crow. If Robinson's speculation is correct, the notebooks illustrate just how determined Khamenei was to help his fellow gay Americans find places where they could live in safety, even joy. Now we'll move on to an article in the prologue section titled Circle Up by Scott Nover. How a quarterback who couldn't hear followed a quiet instinct that changed sports forever. During a tight game in the fall of 1894, Paul Hubbard, quarterback for Gallaudet University Bison, and known as the Eel for his canny maneuvers, made a simple move that changed sports forever. Concerned that his hand signs were tipping off his plans to the opposing defense, Hubbard summoned his offense and directed them to form a circle around him, creating what many consider the first football huddle. For the Bison, who had been fielding football teams since the 1880s, sight matters more than sound. Nestled in northeast Washington, D.C., Gallaudet is the most famous and prestigious deaf university in the world. It's been granting degrees since 1864. The Gallaudet student newspaper, The Buff and the Blue, honored Hubbard in 1941 as the daddy of a huddle, as the daily newspapers in Kansas, where he coached at the Kansas School for the Deaf, and Washington, when Hubbard died in 1946. As with any world-shifting innovation, competing claims emerged over the decades. Herb McCracken, the University of Pittsburgh player and college coach, claimed that he invented the huddle in 1924, and some quarters credit University of Illinois football coach Robert Zupke, also known for inventing the onside kick, the flea flicker, and the screen pass. From Gallaudet's Washington campus, the huddle spread fast across American football. In the 1920s, the formation had become common enough at college games that it even drew complaints from some fans who lamented that it slowed play. But there was no denying the huddle, which inevitably took over basketball, baseball, and other sports, offering a universal protection for the devious language of athletic strategy. Next, we'll take an article from Prologue again about art, titled Fresh Take by Amy Crawford. In her monumental work, the artist reimagines a much-depicted story from antiquity. The Rape of the Sabine Women, an episode in which Rome's legendary founders forcibly abducted brides from a nearby community, has been a popular subject in painting and sculpture since the Renaissance. So popular, in fact, that we may miss the brutality of the original myth. There's almost this sense of familiarity blindness to those stories, says American artist Jesse Mochrin, who depicts the Sabine drama from the perspective of the women themselves in her large-scale 2024 painting, The Descent, one of more than 12 new works on view in a solo exhibition opening at Toronto's Art Gallery of Ontario in September. Riffing off 16th and 17th century Baroque artists like Caravaggio and Peter Paul Rubens, who brought new levels of technical virtuosity and theatrical flair to scenes from Bible and mythology, Mochrin asks viewers to reconsider themes of sex, gender, and violence that run through the Western canon. At the same time, she resists the contemporary culture impulse to tear down statues and reject our past for its flaws. I think the old masters were masters. I feel like a fan to some extent, she confesses. I also feel like I can be critical of the messages inherent in those works and conscious of trying to update them to a female perspective in this moment. You can see the full painting and more of Mochrin's artwork at smithsonianmag.com/descent. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, generously underwritten by the Kepin family. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.